Many of us these days spend time online at social networking sites, Facebook, say, or MySpace or LinkedIn. And if you use those sites, you know how easy it is to happily fritter away hours in the Twitterverse or some other online community. But what happens if you get sick of all those messages on your Facebook wall? Well, the brains behind a website called Web 2.0 Suicide Machine offer this encouragement to end it all. Virtually.
It doesn't make your life better. You always think you're missing something. And above all, it makes you more stupid.
Gordon Savicic is the CEO, which he says stands for Chief Euthanasia Officer of SuicideMachine.org. He joins us on the phone from Vienna. And tell me, the idea here is what? To abandon your virtual life so you can get your actual life back?
Well, that was certainly one of our intentions. Basically, we try to remove as much content as possible. We change the profile picture and the password so you can't log in anymore.
So what happens if I were to go log into suicidemachine.org? Mm-hmm. What do I see? How does it work?
What happens is you click commit, and then you see
click commit.
A pop-up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There you see basically a remote desktop session. So you see how a web browser is being started. And then, depending on the service you chose, you will see that the machine logs into your account. You see your friend list, and then basically the machine starts, based on our scripts, to remove the friend connections of everyone. Or in case of Twitter, we remove the followers and the people you follow. It changes your profile picture, changes your password, and finally it logs out.
So one by one, deleting your friends online. You watch them disappear.
You can take time and relax in front of the computer and see how your 2.0 life is passing away.
What happens if you change your mind halfway through?
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
Because we can't stop it and also the process.
Well, have you had a lot of interest? How many people have signed up?
We have around 900 users. And since last Sunday, Facebook blocked our service.
Facebook has blocked your service.
They basically didn't like the idea that we are unfriending other people's accounts. And we still have to decide how we react on that.
That's Gordon Savicic from SuicideMachine.org, which will help you commit social media suicide. It's the idea of a group called Modder. That's a bunch of artists, designers, and programmers based in Rotterdam. Facebook released a statement earlier this week saying Suicide Machine violates their rules of user interaction. The company says it is, quote, currently investigating and considering whether to take further action. This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I want to tell you a little story and see if you recognize it. It's the story of a 30-something-year-old woman, a New Yorker, who's been through a terrible, nasty divorce. So she decides to take a year for herself to travel and try to heal. The woman starts in Italy, where she gorges on pasta and gelato. That's the pleasure part of the trip. Then she heads to India for yoga and meditation. And finally, she visits Indonesia, where she tries to find balance, but ends up, as you do, meeting a handsome Brazilian man, 17 years her senior, and falling madly in love. All right, if this is all starting to sound familiar, that's because it's the story of Elizabeth Gilbert's mega best-selling memoir from 2006 called Eat, Pray, Love. The book spent more than a year at the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list. So if that's not a hard act to follow, I don't know what is. But Elizabeth Gilbert decided to try, and she's got a new book coming out called Committed. She joins us from our New York bureau to talk about it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Mary Louise.
So we should start with the title, Committed.
A little double meaning?
It's a little bit of a giveaway. And I'm sure there were many readers still in suspense. We mentioned that at the end of Eat, Pray, Love, where that left off, you had recently met this Brazilian man, and I guess we can reveal you made it. You're still together.
We're still together. Yeah. It wasn't just a shipboard romance, as my grandmother said.
Congratulations. Tell us about the new book.
Well, it was a kind of an accidental book. I didn't have any intention of writing another memoir, but what happened is that, as readers of Eat, Pray, Love know, I did meet that lovely, handsome Brazilian man, and we made a pretty fierce commitment to each other that we would stay together forever but never marry. Both of us were survivors of bad divorces, and I suppose I don't need to explain to anybody why that would make somebody hesitant to enter into the institution of matrimony again. And we were very happily living out our lives. The problem was he wasn't a U.S. citizen, and every time he came to visit me, there was the, you know, the famous border crossing in Homeland Security and the INS. And one of these border crossings turned sour one day in Dallas-Fort Worth, and they peeled him out of the line and chucked him in jail and threw him out of the country. And I was informed by a man named Officer Tom at the Homeland Security Department in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport that the only way I could get him back was to marry him. So we like to say that it was an arranged marriage, arranged by the INS.
by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Yes, exactly. As your parents there.
They were holding the shotgun in the case of this shotgun marriage.
But that took 10 months or more. And so in the meantime, y'all were you were in exile together in a way.
We were, and in a way that can sort of only make sense to us, but made perfect sense to us at the time. Naturally, what we did was just go to Southeast Asia and waited out there, traveling across Thailand and Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, sort of killing time and hoping to get back in.
So is this new book committed? Is it a sequel to Eat, Pray, Love?
I don't mind if people call it a sequel. It would certainly be recognizable to people as it's my voice, and obviously these are two characters who you meet in Eat, Pray, Love. The way that I see the difference between the tone of Eat, Pray, Love and the tone of Committed is the tone of romance versus the tone of marriage.
Still in love, but a little more sober.
We've turned on all the fluorescent lights. Let's just put it that way. And I very much wanted to. I thought, let's try to strip the tone of romance out of this and really pick this thing apart.
During those months, you interviewed housewives, Hmong housewives in Vietnam, poets, psychologists. At one point, I noticed you were quoting advice from Miss Manners on what makes a good marriage. You cast the net wide, and what did you come back with?
I really had such an aversion to matrimony when I started this, and I actually feared when I started to do research on marriage that the more I discovered about it, the more I would loathe it, you know, especially as a woman. What I didn't expect was to come away with this respect for marriage, and I say that in a guarded sense because I don't want to be mistaken for somebody who has respect for marriage that's so hardline that they want to pass legislation about it. You know, what I'm talking about is a sort of historical respect for something that I discovered is not quite the rigid, boxy institution that I thought it was, but is in fact an ongoing, millennia-long experiment in social living that is being tinkered with and altered with every generation, you know, with every culture, every couple who comes into it puts their mark on it, and it has an almost Darwinian survival that I found really impressive.
I gather that you at one point had an entire draft of this book completed and ready to ship it off to your publisher, and you decided you were going to throw the whole thing away.
Yeah.
How come?
Because it was horrible. It was not fit for human consumption. It was a terrible, terrible book. And it's an awful realization to have something like that happen because I worked on it for, you know, close to 2 years and quite diligently and optimistically the way that one does when one is writing. And it came to me quite suddenly when I printed it out for the first time and opened it up to a random page and read a random paragraph and realized I had really misstepped. And I realized the entire book was wrong.
In what way? Was it the way you were telling the story or the story itself?
Well, at the time, I couldn't quite tell. All I knew was that it was off. And what I know now and what I can see now is that I was trying to appease 6 million Eat, Pray, Love readers when I wrote the first draft of the book. And I had them in the room with me. And I was writing it by committee, imaginarily consulting them as I was going and saying, is this what you liked about Eat, Pray, Love? Did you want more of this with the goofy stuff? You want jokes? Do you want, you know, lightweight? What? You want spiritual things? So the whole thing was very forced and inauthentic. And it became a book that I became certain that nobody would like. I just couldn't put it out there.
It must be wonderful, obviously, to write a book that 6 million people have bought and loved, but it must also be intimidating to think of all those people waiting for whatever you're going to write next.
Yeah, just to be clear, this is the exact definition of what we call a champagne problem.
There are worse issues. My heart is bleeding too much for you.
Yeah, please feel sorry for me about that. You know, it's really not that bad in terms of things that happen to people in the world at all. It's just a puzzle, you know. It's a kind of creative puzzle to figure out how you write unselfconsciously again after that. And you really have to narrow down who you're telling the story to. And it wasn't until I narrowed the book down to, you know, 24 people, the women in my life, my sister, my mother, my stepdaughter, my neighbors, all the people who I spend my life talking to. And it just makes a lot more sense now.
It's interesting that that circle that you just described, that you say you narrowed it down to the people you had in your mind as you were writing this, all women, unless I'm mistaken. And yet this is a book about your happy marriage to a man.
Yeah, but what you have to understand is that, you know, we live in this time of this radical new social experiment, and I think sometimes we forget how new it is. And the radical, unprecedented new social experiment is, what happens if we give women autonomy, education, finances, you know, control over their sexual biology? What happens if we give you all this freedom? What are you going to do with it? We have like 20 decades of role models on how to do that. And we're all still sort of puzzling it out in a very intense way. And what differentiates, I think, the conversations that women have about intimacy from those that men have, you know, can be exemplified by the fact that when I was 19 years old and I was in college at NYU, my friends and I would sit up until 2 a.m. and sort of panic over how we were going to balance raising our children, being married, and having careers. And I kind of don't think the guys down the hall in the dorm were doing that when they were 19, but we already saw it coming. And this book is sort of picking up the thread of a conversation that I think I've been having with my friends for 20 years.
I have one last question for you. I don't want to let you go before we ask about there's a movie being made about Eat, Pray, Love, the first memoir.
And I heard that too.
Well, and I heard you're being played by Julia Roberts, which
I heard that too.
Must be a little surreal.
No, it's so beyond surreal that I have to say I have not even really begun to process it. I think that maybe when I'm in my 70s, I'll start to unthread how that happened. So it'll be nice because she's sort of going back and reliving my journey, and they're filming it. So it's like I'm going to have a home movie of my trip, but portrayed by someone with flawless skin and 36-inch legs.
Elizabeth Gilbert, we're glad you came in to talk to us today about your new book, Committed. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
It used to be that if you were a high school senior and you had good grades, a decent SAT score, played a sport or an instrument, maybe did some volunteer work, that was enough to pretty much guarantee you a spot at your local state university. Well, not anymore. That's because so many public universities are cash-strapped these days, so they're courting out-of-state students because they pay higher tuition fees than in-state students. We're joined by Barmak Nasirian. He's with the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers, and welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So let me start by asking you, how widespread a trend is this?
I think it's fair to describe it as a national trend. Most public institutions have experienced better than 2 years of budget cuts by now. They are often very restricted in terms of how much they can increase tuition for their in-state students. So out-of-state applicants have become particularly appealing to them just as a matter of balancing their budgets.
So this is a trend across the country, not focused in any particular area.
I would say it's a very detectable trend. Obviously, it has variations. Some places are significantly more selective than others. But in general, the one statement that I do think is true is that most public institutions are far more selective today than they were 10 or 20 years ago.
And we're talking about this trend of state schools increasingly looking to out-of-state residents because they pay more money. Can you give us any sense of to what degree that's happening? Is this a tiny thing around the margins, or is this a big deal, a big trend?
This is a feature of the dysfunctional ways in which the publics are funded in the United
States.
The public universities are funded by their respective states. Because, of course, precisely at the point where families who have arguably paid into the system through state taxes for years, sometimes decades, it's at the point that they need these institutions the most that the institutions are least able to meet the demand. Why? Because the states tend to fund these institutions on an annual basis. And Governor Schwarzenegger
in California
has proposed early utopian idea of restoring higher education back to what it used to be 30 years ago. when 10% of the state's budget used to go to higher ed.
Let me ask you about academic standards and how that factors in here. Is it true that students applying from out of state are going to be held to a higher academic standard than those applying in-state? How does that work?
That has been true always, and it remains true clear across the board. In-state applicants have better odds of being admitted to their respective state institutions. So what we're talking about is not so much that public institutions are going to now favor out-of-state applicants. It's just that they will take larger numbers of them than they have historically.
So bottom line, if you're a student polishing your resume and sending it off with your application, hoping for admission to your state university, any tips, anything they should be doing to help guarantee or help ensure that their success with that application?
Well, I mean, at one level, the advice I can give them is fairly obvious and perhaps even trite, you know, study. Be as well prepared as you can be academically and otherwise, because that is the coin of the realm when it comes to admissions. In good times and bad, better prepared students who can document their progress over time will be viewed more favorably. And as much as we are disappointed with the overall budgetary situation when it comes to public higher education, it remains true that in the United States, any student who seeks to access higher education still can do so. And the last thing I want to do is to give any sense that that has fundamentally changed, because there is a place for everybody who seeks one.
Be flexible and look around.
Absolutely.
Sounds like that's
do
the
your
advice.
Homework.
That's Barmak Nasirian. He is Associate Executive Director of the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers. Join me in our studios in Washington. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Scott Simon. This week, President Obama talks terrorism with his security advisors. A federal grand jury indicts the man accused of trying to blow up a Northwest Airlines flight. And prominent Democrats announce they won't run for re-election. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore is with me. Nice to see you, Dan.
Oh, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Good to be here. Well, the big story this week continues to be terrorism.
Yes.
And President Obama came out and gave a couple of speeches on that after he came back from his holiday vacation this week. How did he do?
Well, I think he was a little slow off the mark, if I must say. He was in Hawaii and didn't seem to react very much when the news came in of the attack on the Northwest plane. And then he decided he had to say something. And he seemed to move from a position of not wanting to alarm Americans too much and yet alarming them enough to realize that something very important had happened.
Now, all this, of course, is prompted by the questions about Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who's now been indicted on charges that he tried to blow up this flight en route to Detroit.
Right.
Intelligence agencies scrambling all this week, trying to explain how it was that they managed not to connect the dots, that they managed to allow this man to walk onto a flight.
Yeah, well, I suppose not connecting the dots gives you some sense that there are a lot of things just waiting to be connected. We're dealing here with a database of 500,000 names. And I think I can understand, if nobody else seems to be able to understand, that it is very, very difficult to put all that together.
Do you think anybody should be held accountable for what happened?
Well, I'll follow the president on this. First, he talked about mistakes being made and did the typical passive tense mistakes were made. But finally, he came out where he had to come out, where Truman came out. The buck stops here.
I wonder what you think this episode says about the nature of the war against al-Qaeda and its sympathizers. This idea that even as President Obama and his administration are really focused on trying to fight terrorists along that Afghanistan-Pakistan border we hear
right.
so much about, meanwhile you have these offshoot groups that can plot operations from elsewhere.
That's exactly right. And they're being given all kinds of opportunities now in Yemen, for example, where you have a very weak government. Some speak of a failing government. Some say it's a government which practically has failed. That is where this guy went, and that's where he found his training and all of that. It is very, very difficult to keep track when things are in the hands of a government that can't even govern very well. And that's what we have now, a series, one after the other, of where the training takes place by the Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan, Pakistan, one place, and now the latest entry into the field, Yemen.
Another challenge for this still relatively new Obama administration. Well, meanwhile, midterm elections coming up this year, and the political maneuvering is already underway. Democrats looking for ways to hold on to that very slim majority that they have in the Senate. And now we get news that two longtime Democratic senators, Chris Dodd and Byron Dorgan, are not running for re-election.
That's right. And that makes four Democratic seats now in the Senate that may be up for grabs during the next election. It tends to be true that a party in power in a general election loses some strength in the first off-year election. It tends to be true, and that may be true here. Here, in addition, there's the fact that the country is simply not happy with its government, either the Congress or with the presidency. There are all these terrible problems that the country faces, and they tend to say, you're in charge, why don't you fix it? And they don't get fixed very easily. This tends now to work against the Democrats. And at the moment, it begins to look as though the Republicans are coasting towards important gains. But I say at the moment it looks, because other things can happen between now and next November, which may change that.
We're talking politics and moving on to health care. The House returns from winter break this coming week. They're going to start ironing out differences between the House and the Senate version of the health care bills. These negotiations, though, are mostly going on in private. That's unusual. What happened to transparency?
What happened to yes, didn't President Obama, when campaigning, said that he would let the thing open for to be seen by C-SPAN? All on C-SPAN. Well, it didn't happen, and it is not likely to happen. The fact of the matter is, when you come down to the wire, and there are very delicate little things you've got to change and agree upon, so it really works better if you do it in private, and they know that. So what they've done for the first time is to say, while normally we would have a Senate-House conference on this question, they're saying now, well, before that, we'll have a little kind of private attempt to resolve these things. And so transparency, it ain't.
Transparency, it ain't. Last thing we want to hit, Dan, the economy. Lots of folks out there had their fingers crossed for some positive news. There were some glimmers of hope back in November. But now we hear employers cut 85,000 jobs in December. That's more than we expected. Unemployment rate steady, 10%. Right. What do you make of that? Is the recession lasting longer than expected?
Well, that part of the recession certainly is. I mean, there have been improvements in other areas, but what really counts for most Americans anyway is jobs, jobs, jobs. And you get the, as you suggested, you get the unemployment figure about 10%. And as long as that number doesn't move, we cannot speak of recovery.
NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore. Dan, great pleasure to get to interview you. Thank you.
My pleasure.